We made this. You're listening to Free with this month's issue. As always, please support the bands and artists featured in each episode by buying their records and going to their gigs. Each episode we'll be adding all available tracks to our ongoing Spotify playlist, which you can find on redigpodcast.com. You can also find our other episodes and podcasts there. If you want to agree with us, or more likely argue with us, or even appear in a future episode, you can find us on Twitter at This Month's Issue and Facebook at Free with This Month's Issue. Also, if you enjoy the podcast, then let people know. Like, subscribe, review it on iTunes, tattoo it on your forehead, etc. Right, let's get on with it then.
Hello, welcome to Free With This Month's Issue. I'm Ian, and my dog shook up my cans of beer before we started this recording. So, apologies in advance in case I swear a lot when I open the second can.
Nice one, Sabah.
All cardboard boxes are her cardboard boxes, apparently.
Right. Brilliant.
I knew this beforehand. I have not learnt. Anyway, yes, on this podcast we discuss free magazine CDs.
We do.
Probably don't get them anymore. I don't know. I can't remember the last time I saw.
You still get them on some magazines. Mojo still has one every issue.
Ah, yes. But and the old person-centric magazines for people like us, yes, that still have CD players.
Yes, those ones.
But this is from when we were younger, when everyone had CD players. That's but what this the, is.
The youth, what buys Kerrang these days, probably...
Fucking hell, Colin.
MP3 players.
Make us sound like a bunch of old cunts, won't it?
We are.
Just straight away. We don't have to sound like them, though, do we? We don't.
May as well. I look like one.
Fair. Fair enough. That's a good point. Anyway, who have we got with us today, Colin?
Well, I'm quite excited about this one. Our guest this month is Simon Jones, who was the drummer in one of my favourite bands of all time, Hope of the States. As such, he's responsible for one of the pinnacles of all human achievement, which is the bit where the drums come back in at about 4 minutes 40 seconds into Black Dollar Girls. So, hi, Simon.
Hello. Yeah, thank you very much. I mean, that wasn't much of an achievement. It's more laziness that there weren't drums prior to that.
Well, it works really well.
Yeah, good. So, good. My laziness improved your life.
It has indeed, mate. It has. We normally say, what CD have you brought for us? But it's a tape.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I say I've bought the tape. I dug mine out of the garage and it's got mould on it. So luckily you managed to copy it. Steve Lamacq's bootleg session from Melody Maker in, I think it's 98.
It was. It was March the 7th, 1998 was the issue that it came with. So, Simon, what's your history in the music magazine? What kind of things did you used to get?
I mean, I used to buy BBC Fast Forward when I was a teenager.
Amazing.
So I just had a load of pop magazines. But obviously, you get to secondary school and people laugh at you if you still read Fast Forward or Look In. So, so you know, grew my hair out, got lots of spots, wore extremely skinny girls' T-shirts and listened to a lot of Suede. And so, I mean, I read Melody Maker and Enemy and Vox and whatever else was around at the time. I mean, I think that was about it, wasn't it? Did anyone read anything else? Apart from Kerrang, but that was a bit...
It was Select as well.
Select.
In that kind of area.
Yeah.
Q, but that's a little bit more...
That's for grown-ups, mate. I was 15.
It is, yeah. I used to read my dad's copy of Q when I was about that age, but yeah. Then I started getting it later on. Cool. And then, obviously, later on, you were in them. So, that was cool.
Yeah. Yeah, it was... I mean, it's still... My mum's got a big pile of every magazine and kind of newspaper article we ever did. And it's still a slight... it is a strange thing to have done and a strange thing to look back on. Yeah. Yeah. Because you do grow up reading all these things. And then 5 minutes later, it feels like you're in them. And you don't really equate yourself to the other things in it. So, it's a strange feeling.
Awesome. There was one Hope of the States review that I'm actually in.
Is that because of what you did?
Yes. Yeah, so there was a gig at Nottingham Rescue Rooms. I went to see Hope of the States probably 12 or 13 times over sort of about a 5-year wow. period. And Rescue Rooms in Nottingham, there was a gig where I'm in the front row in the audience, and there's a photo. Unfortunately, you're just out of shot, Simon, because the drum kit was a little bit further back on the stage. But yeah, it's got me right in front of Sam. And then partway through the gig, I thought that was a good time to give him a demo CD, which they actually mentioned in the review as being a massive faux pas. Said basically at Godspeed You Black Emperor gig, you'd have been like hung, drawn and quartered for that. But Sam just smiles and reads out a few song titles.
I mean, what made you think that was a good point?
Well, I did it at a Mogwai gig as well, and it worked all right then.
Oh, did it? Well, fair enough. Fair enough.
I just had a habit of, I'd got the CD with me, I might not see the band at the end of the gig.
No, it's good. That was the good thing, always the good thing about the Rescue Rooms was that it had a separate bar. Because there's loads of places you play, and then you'd come off stage and you'd be like, right, let's go and get a drink and let's go and see some people or whatever.
Yeah.
And then you'd, you know, dry yourself off, get changed, walk out, empty venue, apart from, you know, your roadies and a pissed sound man or something.
Yeah.
And then at least at the Rescue Rooms, it's got a bar.
Yeah, and there was always club nights later on, so people would hang around and that kind of thing.
Exactly.
Cool, right, so give a bit of context of the time. In March 1998, music news, Liam Gallagher is charged with assault for breaking a fan's nose after he took a photo of him, and then less than a week later, he was banned from the Cathay Pacific airline for being abusive to passengers and crew on a flight to Australia. So, general bellendery.
Always been a bellend.
That was when he wanted to get a muffin, wasn't it?
I think you might be right.
That's like the famous muffin story.
Yeah, that was the plane one, wasn't it?
Yeah, and didn't he say something along the lines of, I just wanted a fucking muffin?
Yeah, that does ring a bell, definitely. Lemmy claims that he stormed out of a recording of Nevermind the Buzzcocks, although it then got pointed out that he didn't actually storm out until right at the end when they finished filming, so it wasn't the sort of highest impact storm out ever. Preston from the Ordinary Boy beat that, obviously, later on. And
that one was great.
One of my favourite bits of music news ever, Mark Morrison of Return of the Mac fame, was arrested and sentenced to jail for paying a lookalike to perform his court-appointed community service for him while he went out on tour.
That's some solid work, that is. I always thought it was weird that his debut single was about returning. Like, where have you been?
I don't know if... I think he might have had singles before that, but they just didn't have any impact. But yeah, so albums released that month, Space, Tin Planet, Van Halen 3, which was the really shit one with Gary Cherone on vocals, This Is Hardcore by Pulp, Jerry Cantrell, Boggy Depot, and Virtual 11 by Iron Maiden. On tour, there was Tortoise, Spiritualized, Urusei Yatsura, A, Curve, Manson, and Jimmy Nailed. The number one single was My Heart Will Go On by Celine Dion. And a double whammy of horrors, number one album was the Titanic soundtrack. So in the magazine, there's unfortunately Oasis on the cover. There's a very short interview with Leanne Morgan, who was a member of the Spice Girls in the very early days before being replaced by Mel C, before they had any success. Success. She is at great pains in the article to make sure everybody knows she's not bitter, and that her 70s style prog blues band Little Gypsy are playing at the Mean Fiddler later that month.
Okay.
So slight left turn with the musical style there. There's another quite short feature with Richie Sambora from Bon Jovi playing darts. There's interviews with Therapy, Jane Middlemiss, Ultrasound, and Dermot Morgan from Father Ted, and Kaniki review the singles. So we'll get going with the tape. It's a bit of an unusual one, because it's Steve Lamacq's bootleg session. It's formatted like the evening session radio show. So you've got Steve Lamacq popping up here and there to introduce tracks and talk a bit about them afterwards. So some of them, I won't have to introduce them, which saved me a bit of work, so that's good.
Steve Lamacq, Radio 1, 6:30, half past 8. Steve Lamacq, Radio 1, Monday, Thursday night.
So after a short jingle by Gold Blade, this is Ash and Let It Flow. With the Gold Blade bit, there's two jingles on this CD which aren't credited. So I had to do a bit of detective work to find out who that was. So I thought it sounded like China Drum or Snuff. But yeah, it turns out it was Gold Blade, as confirmed by John Robb, the singer of Gold Blade on Twitter, who hadn't heard it in years. But yeah, Ash. I was a big fan of Ash at around this time, but this really isn't one of their more memorable songs.
Not going to mince my words there, it sucked.
The same session, they did I'd Give You Anything, Lose Control, and a really good cover of Get Ready by The Temptations. And any of those three would have been a much better choice, I reckon. But yeah, it's definitely my least favourite track on 1977, which is, on the whole, a pretty good album. But yeah.
Obviously, it's a session as well, so not only is it a slightly poor song, slightly badly played. Like, it sounds like, it does sound like a kind of, I mean, I guess it was, but it's a load of kids playing a jangly pop song.
Yeah.
Kind of semi-badly.
It was 96, so they were 19.
Tim Wheeler was never good at singing in tune, but this was particularly bad as far as...
I remember Ant from Hope of the States loved Shining Light, and I'd never heard a worse song just ever. It's up there in the worst songs, probably just above, I mean, see, I shouldn't have said that because now I can't think of anything worse.
Like, you've got several Oasis albums to pick from there.
Well, true, yeah, just all of Be Here Now and Later and Earlier.
Is that the real reason that Hope of the States split up then? Because Ant kept playing that on the tour bus.
I mean, it's probably part of it.
Yeah, they can be great, but they're definitely a bit patchy, and that was one of their less good bits. So let's go for the next song.
On average, we get 40 bands a year in to record sessions for us, and here are a few of the most requested ones, continuing with Suede.
As Mr. Lamack said, this is Suede, Saturday Night, session from August 96. This is the second time we've had a Suede song now, but I think this is a much better song than Daddy Speedin' that we covered a few months ago. Coming up, that album always gets overshadowed by Dogman Star, and I massively prefer that period of the band. It's probably my favourite Suede album, I think.
I think...
It's controversial.
Yeah, I think as well... I always think Dogman Star is a bit of a half record, isn't it? You know, you can hear the bit where kind of Bernard Butler walked out and they didn't know what to do.
Yeah.
And I guess no one expected... I mean, I don't really know. I was only 15 or something. But I doubt anyone expected much when they, you know, the main guy or the main creative kind of guy in the band leaves and then you get someone in from an NME advert.
Yeah. And he was really young, wasn't he, Richard Oakes, when he joined?
Yeah, yeah.
I think he was only about 17 or something like that.
And then they got in the... I don't know what the keyboard guy was called, but they got him in just because he was kind of hanging around and he was related to someone.
One thing I did notice that I'd never noticed before listening to this track this week, there's an Elton John instrumental called Song for Guy that I only know because it's the... you know how musicians that aren't piano players quite often have one song they can play on the piano? Mine is the Rugrats theme tune, but my dad's is Song for Guy by Elton John. So I've heard him play it loads of times, and the melody is totally ripped off from that. But I much prefer listening to Saturday Night by Suede than anything by Elton John, really. What's your general thoughts on this one here?
I knew it was Suede straight away, even without the intro, because, you know, Brett Anderson sounds like that, but...
He does, but also the instrumentally they're pretty distinctive with the guitar sounds and stuff.
Oh, for sure,
different
guitarists. I feel like he was a massive Bernard Butler fan before he joined.
Yeah, that's one of the ways he got the job. He turned up and he could play everything out of their discography so far.
I remember this coming out as a single because I remember this the chorus, and I was like, it's a bit fucking sappy, isn't it? And then it got stuck in my head, and I'm like, I fucking hate this now, because I don't want this sappy ass, because I was metal as fuck back then, you know, like, but not in the cool metal way that I am now. This was like fucking Iron Maiden
cool
and
metal
Halloween.
Way.
Yeah, yeah. I'm a lot cooler than I was, right? Obviously.
Obviously. Because you flippin' love suede.
I've always liked suede. It's always quite, like, the guitar playing's always quite interested me and stuff. I quite like the jangly edginess of it.
Yeah. I love suede, and especially if you go back. Obviously, I think post coming up, it kind of fell apart for them, like drugs and band members leaving, and didn't sound like they got on particularly well after that. But you watch kind of early performances, or even ones from coming up, and they had some balls. They kind of put it out there when they played, and there were some great blouses.
Yes. Accurate. Right, let's go for the next track.
Look at me, I'm so disgusting. I will never find another.
It is. It doesn't do anything
very
else.
Very dirty, yeah.
So this is Travis, and The Line Is Fine. Has there ever been a duller band than Travis, particularly early Travis? It's like the sort of audible equivalent of lumpy, flavourless porridge. I mean, later on, they sort of wrote a few tunes, but their really early stuff was just...
dog shit.
Yeah. It's I think I said it before when we've covered them previously. The reason that it always rains on Fran Healy is because it's trying to fucking drown.
Yeah. No, they did that song "All I Want to Do Is Rock," where they didn't at any point.
Yeah, which did this is off that album. That was their early debut stuff. Because,
Like if that's all you want to do, why do you never do it?
What's your general thoughts on this one, Simon?
I mean, yeah, the same. I got given a ticket. I think I must have gone with an ex-girlfriend or something. Probably why ex-girlfriend. And I think we saw them at Wembley, perhaps. And the best bit of the gig was when they stopped in the middle of the gig and let, like, a kid in the front row play Gran Turismo on the giant projection screen. And that's all I remember of that gig.
I think that's going to be a better use of your time, absolutely, than going to a Travis gig.
Exactly.
Right, next song.
Over the last 3 years, the Evening Session has hopefully played its part in bringing a string of new bands to people's attention. There's been Supergrass, The Eels, Arab Strap and Manson, amongst others, all getting their first national radio on the sesh, as did this band whose debut LP we first started playing as an import. These are the Fun-Loving Criminals.
Hey, Steve. Yo, Joe. This one's for you, baby. Radio.
So, this is Fun-Loving Criminals. I've always really, really liked Fun-Loving Criminals. They're kind of trying to be cool so much that they're just going all the way around and ending up being the least cool band in the universe.
Yeah.
But they're always so much fun. And they're a brilliant live band.
I've always loved that lyric, that Kerouac is whack, but I'm down with Dostoevsky.
Yes.
100% agree with you there, Huey. I am a Dostoevsky fanboy, so there you go. Again, when you say down to not being cool, that's how you be not cool.
Yeah.
You say shit like that.
It's also the third person to be mentioned on this episode so far that's had a bit of a strop on Nevermind the Buzzcocks as well.
Yeah,
threw a mug across the room in the intro round.
Well, I mean, he was being like Rizzle Kicks were calling him a one-hit wonder. Like, All right, mate.
Yeah. Yeah.
Where was your other song, Dickholes? He also was responsible for my favourite Nevermind Buzzcocks moment. Because he's pretty pissed. He's already revealed that they gave him beer instead of tea in his mug. Then they asked him to identify the keyboard player from Republica. And he's like,
that was yes.
Right at the start, he's like, says whatever his name is. He's like, out of the bass player in my band was like going out with the
he's
singer
married.
In his band.
Yeah. Yeah.
So he just knew him. Like, all right, John, how's it going?
What's your general thoughts on this one, Simon?
I mean, it's a bit creepy, isn't it? Just the whole lyrics, it's all a bit stalkery. I don't know if we should be... I mean, is there some sort of unconfessed crime?
Well, I mean, they are criminals.
And they fucking yes. love fun.
Yeah,
they do.
I mean... Yeah, and it was never really my bag. I quite like Scooby Snacks or whatever, but
yeah.
we had a monitor engineer who worked with Fun Loving Criminals and just says it was just a copious amount of weed.
that does not
and that you can kind of hear it. I think
that's
that song, isn't it?
Audible amounts of weed. Yeah, yeah. Absolutely. Cool. Right, let's go for the next song. So this is Low Fidelity All-Stars, One Man's Fear, Another Man's High from November 97. This is great. I can't believe that I never really latched onto them at the time. I really like this. And while they were a band that I used to see in NME and Melody Maker and Select and that kind of thing, never really paid much attention. I think I might have to check out How to Operate with a Blown Mind, which was their album from around this time. I reckon this would be so good live. You've got that really cool dubby bass line. I really, really dig this. What's your general thoughts?
I saw them play live a couple of times, you know, around that time. And unlike, because they were on Skint, so they were, you know, Fatboy Slim's label, obviously, Midfield General.
Yeah, yeah.
Bentley Rhythm Ace, you know, kind of more, obviously, the kind of big beat thing that was going on at the time. Whereas Lo-Fi All-Stars were a bit more, live they were a band. They had a bass player with a big star-shaped bass.
like Bootsy Collins.
Yeah, exactly. And the singer kind of had a bit of a kind of like mid-90s kind of baggy look to him, or like some sort of wannabe kind of Stone Roses look. And they were a funny looking bunch, but they were pretty intense gigs. And kind of good. It was good.
What were you thinking on this one, Ian?
I really liked it. Yeah, I mean. It's very dubby, it's very chilled out, very...
Yes.
Mostly I was just hoping it wasn't at all related to Happy Mondays or anything like that, because it kind of sounded a little bit Black Grapey in places. And I knew I was going to say something positive, and I just didn't really want to do that for myself.
It's sort of continuing the audible stoneness from the last track, isn't it?
Yes.
Right, let's go for the next song on the CD, on the tape.
And this will take us up to the break from the show that likes to mosh and go, the Foo Fighters and Friend of a Friend.
Mosh and go.
He needs a quiet. So this is Friend of a Friend by Foo Fighters. This was the first acoustic song Dave Grohl ever wrote, and you can kind of tell. It's just a
Did no one tell him to stop after this point?
Well, no, because he wrote some really good stuff later on.
Yeah.
The first Foo Fighters album is amazing. But this was written on Kurt Cobain's guitar, which you can tell, because the lyrics are about him playing his friend's guitar.
Yeah.
So it's one of those sort of say what you see sort of lyric kind of things. This is a song that was initially released on the Pocket Watch cassette, so predates Foo Fighters by quite a while. This wasn't going to be in the session. They were planning on doing an entire set of covers, so they also recorded Baker Street, Requiem by Killing Joke, and Drive Me Wild by Vanity Six. And they were supposed to be doing a Kansas song as well, but couldn't work out a decent enough version. So at the last minute, Dave Grohl just went, oh, sorry, I'll just do this one then. The Wikipedia page, when I was looking up information on here, claims that this is unreleased. So I edited it the other day to say that it was released on the Melody Maker bootleg session cassette. So yeah, I updated that.
Nice.
Ian, you were quite amused by Steve Lamacq's intro claiming that the show that likes to mosh and go, and then playing the least moshable Foo Fighters song ever, weren't you?
Yeah, like that was just one of those intros, isn't it? Yeah, turn it up loud, this one fucking rocks. I've got Kurt Cobain's blood splattered guitars. I haven't tuned it.
I think it was pre blood splatter.
Kind of sad. I don't... He could have got. Yeah. I'm not saying it's just like brain blood or anything. You know, like,
oh right,
just been general blood.
Yeah,
I don't know.
Yeah, that would make sense.
I'm just trying to write bad lyrics like that.
Yeah, Simon, what are your general thoughts on this one?
I mean, what I realised was obviously I'm sorry that I chose this tape, and also I realised I think. I had this pretty swanky Walkman, right, that would pick up the gaps in songs so that you could skip the songs. Though from what I've realised is that I'd listen to Suede on side A and then I think I just turned the tape over. But fair enough, maybe it has some history, it was on something, but it's not good, is it? I mean, I've always struggled a bit with Foo Fighters because... after the kind of first and second records, it's just rubbish, isn't it?
They've got their moments, but yeah, generally it's
moments that just beg to be adored or played in a stadium or something, and it's really kind of soul. It's like a Muse track, you know, not that song, but Foo Fighters in general. It's just music to be played, you know, well in a big stadium, and that's about it. So
yeah, definitely stadium.
Yeah,
rock.
Whatever. I'm sure they've got very large houses.
Cool, right, let's flip the tape over.
Steve Lamacq on the radio. We are A. So keep it radio.
Sounds like Budget Oasis.
Yep.
I mean, it basically is, isn't it?
It is, yeah. So the first bit on here, there's a bit of a jingle by A, who very kindly announced that they are A, but I knew that.
Proof that their keyboard player has always been playing terrible noises. It's only the second time I've knowingly heard the keyboards in an A song, and they've just been shit both times.
He did like, basically... computer gaming type noises stuck over sort of punk songs basically, but I loved A. They were absolutely amazing for the first couple of albums at least anyway, so they didn't need to announce it was them. If Goldblade could have done that, that would have been really helpful and I wouldn't have had to go on the internet to find out the first track. But anyway, then it's Hurricane Number One, Touchdown, and I really wish it was the other way around. I wish it was a full song by A and only a 30 second jingle by Hurricane Number One, because I mean, Andy Bell was initially in Ride, who lots of people absolutely love. I've never really found anything particularly interesting by him. And then he later joined Oasis. So, unsurprising, because this song sounds like an audition to join Oasis.
Doesn't it just?
It's dull as fuck, and nothing has changed over time with that at all.
I mean, the only thing... Obviously, this is... I'm just looking at the sleeve. This was from 97.
Yeah.
So this is 3 or 4 years after Oasis have kind of, you know, come out. And,
yeah,
Alan McGee has decided to sign. I mean, I'm just guessing there was a lot of cocaine involved for Alan McGee.
It goes without saying.
And, yeah, I mean, the funniest thing, while I was looking at this earlier, I went online and Hurricane Number One reformed last year to play... to play at that, you know, that Shine Festival, which is a lot of reformed late 40-year-olds. and they did a warm-up tour with Embrace and got kicked off of the Embrace tour for rock and roll behaviour.
What?
Oh, amazing. I mean, I've always queried how rock and roll Embrace could be, so...
Not as rock and roll as Hurricane Number One.
Well, seemingly not. It's just staying out past curfew.
They've got to set a limit, and their limit is Hurricane Number One. Nothing higher than that. You know, don't be coming near us with your Jimi Hendrix. You know,
no,
definitely no Motley Crue. Hurricane Number One is the limit. Hate Embrace as well. Should we go for the next song,
please?
Yeah, I think it's best.
Yeah. And we do try to go out on a limb quite often when we're booking bands for sessions. For instance, this next group had played only a handful of gigs when we packed them off to the studio last year, hailing from Edinburgh, and one of the most hyperactive live groups I've seen in a long while. This is Idlewild and Captain.
Idlewild, back when they were a dissonant, noisy punk band, and I fucking loved them. The Captain EP, this track is off. This is the title track of, obviously. This was released only about 2 months before this tape came out, so they were a really new band still at this point, and they hadn't turned into REM yet. But, the Captain EP, it was only released on CD, and they've never reissued it, and they really need to reissue it on vinyl, because I want it, and Annihilate Now on it is probably their best song.
Is it better than that song?
It is better than that song. It's like, it's absolutely brilliant. I like that song.
I feel like Steve Lamacq's taking the piss with his intros, though. Because he's like, first we got, this is really rock and roll, and then it's Dave Grohl and an acoustic guitar. And he's like, this is really hyperactive, and it's like, ding, 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 ding. Like, it kind of picks up a little
really
bit.
Were,
but that song was not. Like, I feel missold by Steve Lamacq.
I saw them live round about this sort of time. I think it was a little bit later, supporting Ash, and they absolutely blew Ash off the stage. Ash was still pretty good, but they were one of the most energetic live bands I've seen at that point, definitely.
Was that the tour with Chicks?
Yes,
as well.
Chicks were fucking terrible.
I saw them at Portsmouth Guildhall. Yeah, I mean, it was the point where Ash had a DJ. Was it
yes.
Confusion is Sound, or whatever it was called, that record?
Nuclear Sounds.
Nuclear Sounds, that's
yeah.
it. And
hilariously, he was on Come Dine With Me, the DJ.
Was he?
I watched the episode of it the other day.
That's
yeah.
brilliant.
Was that his one claim to fame?
Basically, yeah. Yeah, he was like, yeah, yeah, and they were all like, oh my God, he's a rock star. Like, yeah. For like, what? 6 months of touring, and that was it.
Well, I think there was only one song on that record that had audible scratching on it.
Yeah, I looked it up and it was like that one yeah. song. So he was there, and he just walked on stage, did that, and then walked off again.
Brilliant.
The only thing I remember about that gig was that all of Idlewild at the end of the gig were laying on the floor. I'd never seen a whole band end up in that state. The drummer fell off the drum riser.
Yeah.
Everyone else had just somehow ended up laying on the floor. It was some sort of loving, some sort of hippie loving. Get that shit off the stage.
Brilliant. Right, let's go for the next song. Foundation and Charge, another utterly brilliant live band. Asian Dub Foundation are a band that I always thought deserved to be much bigger. I was listening to Raffi's Revenge, their album that this is off earlier, and it's absolutely amazing. There's a track on it called Free Sat Pal Ram, which was one of their singles, that Rage Against the Machine absolutely stole the bass line from for Guerrilla Radio, which came out the year after. But yeah, it's like left-wing politics, drum and bass, dub bass lines, sort of surfy punk guitar, and a bit of rapping. I dig all of that. Chandra Sonic, the guitarist, is absolutely awesome, because he mixes like sitar type scales with the surfy guitar twangs. It's great. I really dig them.
I was thinking it sounds quite a lot like when you go shopping at Glastonbury and you're like, I'm just going to walk through all the stalls and stuff.
Yeah, that's accurate.
Also, it sounds exactly like when you go visit your mate and he's just started smoking weed. Like, dude, I've started smoking weed now. Come round my house. And you just come there and he's got his bong and this is what his room sounds like.
But I don't. But this is what my room sounds like sometimes.
So you are the exception that proves the rule, Colin. You are an anomaly.
Good. I like being an anomaly. Even if I can't say it. What are your general thoughts on this one, Simon?
I really like it, and it's just it's obviously this is kind of 97-98, this tape, and it's kind of post Britpop.
Yeah.
And you can even see from this tape, like, music was in a kind of weird transitional period, wasn't it? You know, even kind of alternative music.
Yeah.
After what had been a pretty kind of straight and poppy kind of time, it's going off in all different tangents on here, and yeah, just really interesting. It's kind of, you know, it's pretty punk rock as well, you know, it's pretty kind of raw.
Yeah.
And kind of lively, yeah. Yeah, I really like it.
Have you ever seen them live?
Yeah, I saw them at maybe Reading 97 or 98. Yeah. So they're on there, you know, probably in between a load of metal bands or something. And I just still remember it. It was amazing. Yeah, it's exactly. Free Sat Pal Ram, that's the tune.
Yeah, absolutely amazing song. It reminds me of being at college, because I can remember walking through the streets of Nuneaton with us, me and two of our mates, just basically sort of singing the riff from that. It's called The Strain. So let's go for the next song.
And this is the band who, analysing their life, recently told The Melody Maker, a lot of our friends have 9-to-5 jobs so they can go on the piss abroad for 2 weeks every year. We get to do it almost every day. These are the Stereophonics.
We all face the same way. Still, it takes all day.
Take just a look to fucking my stop it. I thought I could, but I can't.
I thought that was coming. Like that, I was expecting it sooner.
That intro from Steve Lamacq made them sound like fucking pricks, didn't it?
It did. Like, it did.
We're rock stars, so we get to go on the piss all the time, you sad fucks. Sorry, friends. Friends. You're our friends. Buy our records. We love you. You're great.
I actually really liked Word Gets Around when it was released, their debut album. I hated absolutely everything afterwards. It's very sort of pedestrian, straightforward indie rock.
Yeah.
But there was... Kelly Jones' lyrics had a little bit more to it than a lot of the bands, which kind of set them apart. He was quite good at sort of storytelling. But the best thing about them, obviously, is the fact that the drummer, Stuart Cable, his mum's name is Mabel Cable.
Also, the fact that he was, like, Stuart Cable was a proper legend.
Yeah, he was a lovely guy, actually.
Yep.
Yeah,
but not so much Kelly Jones with his somewhere in between Liam Gallagher and Rod Stewart vocal stylings.
Yeah, do you remember like... they had a pointless double bass drum as well, so that one said stereo and one said phonics. But to play the ploddiest, you know, indie drums, it seemed a little over the top.
Yeah.
Yeah, he was never doing like Dave Lombardo style double kick work, was he?
Exactly.
Although actually, Stuart Cable probably would have wanted to, because he was a bit of a metalhead.
Yeah.
Because he was a DJ on Kerrang for a while, wasn't he?
Mm.
I think. Yeah. But unfortunately, he's died, so there are no cool members of the Stereophonics left.
No.
So let's go for the next track. Unless anybody wants to say anything else.
Fuck no.
No.
Fuck you, Kelly Jones, and your fucking stupid eyebrows.
Next one. This is where you can really hear the tape warble.
Yeah, I was playing this, and my son, who's six, was like, "This sounds weird, Daddy."
Ultrasound and Suckle. I love Ultrasound. They were absolutely preposterous band. They're still going, but at the time, they were sort of just the tail end of Britpop, and they were a prog band releasing like 7-minute long epics, more influenced by the Cardiacs and Yes, sort of in the middle of Britpop where everybody else was aping the Kinks and the Beatles. Their debut album, which was, they only released one album, then split up, then reformed a few years later and put out some more. But their debut album was a double album, which had a 39-minute long title track with a big fucking abstract noise jam.
God damn.
And Tiny, the singer, Andy Wood, he's known as Tiny because he was a very big guy. His vocals could be described as an acquired taste, but I like them. And I absolutely love the way that they blend with Vanessa, their bass player, her vocals. They just work really well together, I reckon. According to the sleeve notes of this cassette, this session nearly didn't happen because Tiny brought his dog with him to Maida Vale and security wouldn't let him in until he just sort of ignored them and wandered in, and they were led to say what we're going to do anyway, just, you know, arrest him for possessing a dog in a built-up studio. But yeah, Ultrasound are great. They're still going. They're touring next year if gigs are back on, and hopefully going to see them for the first time since I saw them supporting Placebo in 98. So, Yeah.
I saw them a few times. I ended up working with, Hope of the States ended up doing some pre-album kind of work with a producer called Sam Williams, who'd done Supergrass's Aisha Coco.
Yeah.
And he'd worked a bit on the Ultrasound first album.
Cool.
And I think if you look at the track listing for that album, it's about one producer per track.
Yes.
Because they were so hard to work with. that every producer walked out.
Amazing.
And so I think it's kind of cut together from loads of different bits and different sessions.
Yeah, yeah.
And all this. I mean, because they were a really big kind of hype band, straight, yeah, like in this post-Britpop kind of void.
Yeah.
And then I think, if I'm right, it was a good while before their first kind of Fierce Panda singles, and then that album came out a year and a half, 2 years later.
Yeah, it was. I definitely remember waiting absolutely ages for the album to come out.
Yeah, but as I said, I saw them a few times. They're a great band. The copy we were listening to sounds rubbish, but considering that's a live take in a Radio 1 studio somewhere, it's pretty decent.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
The Mellotron on that track, I think, Ian, you used to share a studio with it occasionally.
Yep. A lot.
Yeah, because I think Mark Wallace was fixing it for them when you shared a lockup with him.
Yep. Yeah, we shared a lockup with that too. And the synth that played all the keyboard noise on Rock the Casbah as well.
I didn't know that.
We used to share a lockup with Blur, and Blur had, just in between all their gear, there was a Sinclair. Is it a Sinclair C5? That weird little kind of electric motorbike. And I was like, this was never in a video. This isn't a prop that someone's gained. Why has one of Blur stored their Sinclair C5 with the drums?
Fair enough.
Yeah, because they can, I guess.
Yeah. Because they can.
Yeah.
You don't want one of those in your lounge, do you?
No, put it in the studio.
Yep.
Was it a really big studio, so they had to sort of get from one end to the other on it? Or?
No, it wasn't. It was some little... I think it's just where they stored their gear. We used to rehearse there, but I think Blur could afford the next step up.
Yeah, fair enough.
That actually does sound a lot like sharing a room with Wallace, because we'd just walk in and there'd be something in there. What the fuck is this? Mark, why is this here? No, there was, he's like, oh, I just got it. It was really cheap. And?
Brilliant.
Lots of things that are really fucking cheap. You don't just buy them and put them in our room.
Simon. Yeah, cheap isn't always good when it comes to instruments.
No,
yeah,
no, it isn't.
Simon, did you guys do any BBC sessions? Did you do any like Peel sessions or anything?
Never did a Peel. We did three, I think, for Steve Lamacq.
Yeah.
I think we did two pre-recorded ones. Generally, they'd record them on like a Wednesday and it'd go out on the Friday.
Yeah.
Or whatever it was at the time. So it was always quite a nice... it was always a pretty cool day. Like, you'd go to Maida Vale, you'd set up, there'd be, you know, kind of this great BBC equipment.
Yeah.
You go and eat in the BBC canteen, like Alan Partridge or something. It genuinely actually was a bit... I know Alan Partridge said, you're all on the BBC gravy train. It's just people milling about, like kind of people in their early 60s.
Yeah, yeah.
Bumbling about, not a lot to do, drinking tea, wearing cardigans. But they're always good fun. And I do remember doing a live... I think it was a live Zane Lowe one. Yeah. I've never been so scared in my life, because whereas, you know, you play a gig, even if it's to a few thousand people... It's a number and you can kind of see it, but
yeah,
playing live on the radio, knowing that there's, you know, a couple of hundred thousand people listening,
yeah,
it's really scary.
I can imagine it would be. Yeah, yeah. I've only been on the radio to very small numbers of people when Ian used to do a radio show, and I managed to swear and generally make very offensive jokes about George Michael that I really shouldn't have made because I forgot that the mic was on.
Yep. I got fired from that radio station, by the way.
Yeah, but that wasn't because of me.
You don't know that.
That's fair. There was a big gap between the two.
It's because no one listened to my show. And then someone did, and they were like, what the fuck? We need to get rid of this prick. I thought we knew... He said he knew what he was doing. He clearly fucking doesn't. He's an idiot.
Right, let's go for the next song then.
From the session which very nearly didn't happen, see Sleeve Notes for more details. It all turned out okay in the end though for their evening session debut, Ultrasound and the epic Suckle. Before that, Stereophonics with Traffic. And a little like Ultrasound, every so often a band comes along who seems to sit quite nicely outside all prevailing musical trends. And here's a good example of that from the session for us last year, the Beta Band, and this is Shepherd's Dub.
This is the Beta Band and Shepherd's Dub. Starts pretty well. I like dub, and it's got loads of samples from Public Enemy, Countdown to Armageddon, off the start of It Takes a Nation of Millions. And then, yeah, completely collapses, because the bass player, who is probably the most important instrument in dub, completely loses his timing. So it, you know, should be renamed the Could Do Better Band. Because they can, and this is not their best.
But I think, but the The Beta Band. I just call them the Better Band. Your fault. The Beta Band. I mean, they didn't give a fuck, did they?
That is true.
That was half their thing. You know, they told everyone not to buy their first record. they just kind of did what they wanted, and this went out on Radio 1.
Yeah. Which is actually pretty cool when you put it like that, yeah.
Exactly, yeah.
They obviously weren't scared about it. I don't know if this was a live one or not. But yeah, they weren't scared about being out of time in front of thousands of people. So, yeah.
Exactly.
You should learn a lesson from that.
What's your general thoughts on this one, Ian?
I didn't dislike it. I was just drifting off in the general stoned haze that seems to be 50% of this cassette.
Great. Let's go for the final track on the cassette.
And if you like what you've heard on this tape, join us on Radio 1. Steve Lamack, The Evening Session, part of the Radio 1 Sanity Squad from Mondays to Thursdays, 6:30 to 8:30. Sessions, new records, interviews and a few cock-ups as well. I'll leave you with this, though, from a band who seem to have a remarkably similar philosophy to ours. Gaz from Supergrass told The Melody Maker, "No matter how unrehearsed we are, we get on stage and it'll probably be quite a smart gig. A man after our own hearts. This is Strange Ones." There's a place where the strange ones go, where nobody here could know. They look down from the clouds and smile at everyone down below. There's a place where the strange ones go, where nobody here could know. They look down from the underground at everyone. So this is Supergrass with Strange Ones. Supergrass probably at their sort of punkiest on this one. It's good. It's not a track I've particularly got much to say about, though. I've been racking my brains of what to say about this one for the last week, and it's like, yeah, it's all right.
Sounds like a children's TV show. Like a shit children's TV show, yeah.
It would work quite well as a theme tune to a kids' TV programme.
What are you watching? Like The Strange Ones? Oh, okay.
Yeah. Yeah, I like Supergrass. They're good, but they're not massively interesting.
They just always seem like... Kaz Coombs always seems so fucking happy. He operates at a level of cheerfulness that I've never really managed to attain, other than, like, maybe, you know, like, when I got married, that was pretty fucking up there, but I'm still not sure whether I'm on a par with Kaz Coombs' levels of fucking cheer. I'm not sure whether I'd be comfortable operating at that kind of intensity anyway, to be honest.
Just all right, then.
Fuck you, Colin.
Simon, what are your general thoughts on this one?
I love Supergrass.
Yeah.
And I quite like that song. It's one of the first Supergrass songs I remember hearing. And it's like... I sometimes think that there may be the kind of underrated... I think people always put them in the bracket of that Britpop thing, and they kind of went on to do some more interesting things, I think, later. And Gaz Coombs' solo stuff's been, you know, pretty interesting as well.
I think
it's better than... It's better than you two are saying.
No, that's fair. I really like Supergrass, and I like his solo stuff as well. I've seen Supergrass live a few times. I've just been finding it difficult to think of anything particularly to say, even though they're really good.
Yeah, but then I don't think you're meant to. It's like a teenage kind of,
yeah,
you know, speedy little rock song,
which is great. And it's
exactly,
yeah. No, I'm fine with that. That is all good. I think that brings us to the end of the podcast then. So thank you very much for joining us, Simon. It's been a pleasure.
No problem.
Is there anything that you want to sort of plug or tell people to?
Oh, I suppose... I suppose I better plug... I have a little record label that does soundtracks.
Awesome.
So you should go and check that out. minimumrecords.net.
Okay.
Go there. We do a lot of video game vinyl and stuff. Go and have a look. Don't follow me on Instagram or anything unless you want to see pictures of my kids.
Yeah, fair enough. You followed us, so I followed you. Yeah.
Exactly. That's fair.
No, that's I've got the same on mine. Most of it is either records or pictures of my daughter doing something stupid.
Exactly.
But yeah, no, thank you very much for joining us. It's been ace, and we'll be back next month. We'll be back next month for our Christmas episode, because it's December. So yeah, thanks for listening. Bye.
Another endearingly shambolic podcast from WeDigPodcasts.com.
Elsewhere on We Made This. Cerebral Jukebox.
Yeah, because we were talking about this. We've talked about the different covers there are. Now, you yourself, I thought I'd found a nice little sort of hidden gem here, because you yourself were in a band called Bleeder, or still are in a band called Bleeder.
Yeah.
And when I was looking on Spotify just for different covers of the song, I noticed there is a cover of this by a band called Bleeder. And I was like, oh, brilliant. This is what Niall's not told me, is that he's actually done a cover of it that got released.
Shipwrecked and Comatose, a Red Dwarf podcast.
Maybe I'm not coming at it from an educated point of view, because, you know, not only am I a man, I'm gay. You know, I don't deal with pregnancy.
Are you?
And
and have you ever told us that before?
I was trying to make a serious point.
Hey, we love you, you know that.
Yeah. But yeah, you have got a good point, Colin. This is a bit of a sausage fest episode. Maybe we should have got a lady involved.
Real Asian podcast.
You know, so I really do feel that there's this, and whether it's an invisible weight on our shoulders to be able to be like this ideal child, or like, you know, just being able to not drag the family name down for whatever reason, even if it's self-imposed,
even if it's just completely made up in your mind.
Right, like you know, Brian, you were just saying about your friend who said they felt like they couldn't come out to you.
Check out all of these shows and more on the We Made This podcast network.